Hello and welcome to the Sonic Cinema Podcast. My name is Brian Scuttle and thank you for joining me at www.sonic-cinema.com as well as the Sonic Cinema Podcast YouTube channel. You can click subscribe, rate, and review wherever the podcast is available, and whether it's Good Pods, Apple, Spotify, pretty much anywhere podcasts are available, you can find it. And any subscriptions, likes, shares, all of that is appreciated. You can also join us at patreon.com/sonic cinema. There you will find a Life soundtrack, Losing the Collection, brief thoughts on older movies I've watched for the first time, including actually all three of the movies that we are going to be focusing on today. And as well as more, including film festival coverage, Oscar discussion, all of that is at patreon.com/sonic cinema. So I think everybody who is a movie lover, I think everybody has certain blind spots in their movie watching. And I certainly am not alone in that. In the past few years, I've finally really started to dig into the work of John Cassavetes as well as today's subjects. And that is the directorial team of Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger, better known as The Archer. I'd seen Powell's Peeping Tom several years ago, but I'd never seen one of their collaborations until a few years ago when I watched one of the movies that we're talking about today, and they're our subject. And join me once again on the podcast. We had wonderful discussion on Barbara Stanwyck last year. I'm so glad to have him back. Please welcome back to the podcast, Matthew St. Clair. Matthew, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks for having me again.
Before we get started, where can people find you online?
Yeah, sure. You can follow me on Twitter at filmguy619, Instagram matt.saint.clair92, and you can also check out my freelance work at places like Awards Watch, The Film Experience, In Session Film, and also my Substack, Cinematic Words of a Chaotic Gemini, at matthewstclair.substack.com.
Okay, excellent. And like I said, I absolutely love the discussion that we had on Barbara Stanwyck. I know another one of your favorite actresses from the golden age of Hollywood is Deborah Kerr. And I know you've professed your love for one of the films that we're going to be talking about online several times. And so that's kind of what made me have the idea of having you talk about The Archers with me. What has been your experience with Powell and Pressburger over the years?
Well, I remember my intro was Peeping with Michael Powell with Peeping Tom, mm-hmm. which I know was critically derided when it first came out, but it's an absolute masterpiece that helped, which helped give birth to the slasher genre.
Yeah. And I know by the time I saw Peeping Tom, I was aware of the reputation it had when it came to filmmakers and how influential it was with filmmakers. So, I mean, you know, obviously the critical derision was somewhat surprising to me because of the fact that when you watch it, it's such a visceral piece of filmmaking in terms of how it uses filmmaking as part of the story. And the way it uses the camera as a fundamental part of the terror in that movie. And one of the things that as I was going through the three movies that we're going to be talking about with The Archers, one of the things I was so struck by is that I think a lot of people often have a very common way of looking at the golden age of Hollywood and the way that the camera moves and the way that sound is used, the way that color was used, and the 40s and 50s. And I mean, now granted, I mean, so one of the things I find so interesting about their work, and I mean, they are, they're from, they're British filmmakers, so they're not working within the Hollywood system, is you look at something like The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, especially, and it feels very much like a biopic in a lot of ways, but it moves in a way that is, it moves, it has a pacing, it has a feel to it that really is almost unlike anything we really see in the genre, even now.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I think one way it does so is by one way of doing that is through Deborah Carr's performance and how, mm-hmm. as she plays three different women who are like products of each time period the movie follows us in.
Yeah, the thing that I am struck by so much about the performances by Karn, it's a shame that this, I mean, I think between Fursinity, certainly, I think this performance probably has a lot of the same acclaim as, say, Peter Sellers in Dr. Strangelove, who's very well known for playing four different characters. So the fact that, but when you think about her in this role, I love how each performance is very distinct from one another. She's not just playing different versions of the same character, even though that is basically the projection on General Candy, the idea that these other women are basically reminding him of this English woman he met in Germany and has, and almost in a way, has never gotten over. And I think that's such an interesting, it's such an interesting choice in the storytelling to have Carr play all three of these characters. And it's one that makes all the sense in the world because of the fact that ultimately this is essentially about Candy's perspective of the world. And that's one of the ways in which he sees his world unfold.
Oh, definitely. And I think what's also genius about Carr's performance, even though she never she doesn't alter her voice or her or go through makeup, she still finds ways to. It's always in like her, at least her demeanor, or her attire, or where it's clear that she's playing three different people.
Yeah. No, definitely. And
I always like to do a personal awards ballot, so where do you think Deborah Carr would fall, lead or supporting?
Deep down, I would like to say lead, because obviously she is the main female presence in the film. But I mean, you can certainly see where somebody would say supporting, just because of the fact that she's not playing a single character throughout. But at the same time, I can't imagine her anything other than a lead.
Yeah. And then again, she is mostly told through the protagonist's point of view.
Yeah.
So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess I would say, I mean, it's not as bad. I mean, like, if she were, like, nominated in supporting, it wouldn't be as, like, with Rooney Mara and Carol.
Yeah.
Or that, it wouldn't be that level of egregious, but I would get the supporting argument.
I mean, I would obviously prefer in Lee. That would make the most sense to me, because she is the main actress in the movie. I think she's just as important as Livesy as is in the film, and I think it's just that important of a role. I mean, you know, especially if I mean, you know, it's obviously a go-to when it comes to, you know, questionable categories. But look, Anthony Hopkins got nominated in lead actor for 25 minutes as Hannibal Lecter. But he got nominated in lead because it's such an important performance in the movie. And such an important character in the movie. That's why he has such a presence in that movie. And, I mean, I think you have to use the same logic for Kerr. And she's wonderful in this movie. Her and Lively just have amazing chemistry in this movie together. And it's just absolutely wonderful.
Oh, definitely.
And, I mean...
You get...
And, I mean, I love that, you know, it's like... This movie, to me, strikes me a little bit like Citizen Kane, where it's, you know, it's an original creation by Powell and Pressburger. They're not adapting somebody's work. It's basically their take on a biopic by using a fictional character, and they're using a fictional character to reflect on the ways in which people viewing the British Empire in one way are real, have life kind of passing them by in a way. And I think that's one of the most striking things about the film from a thematic level. But I love the fact that this is just a genuinely entertaining movie all the same. It just has an energy to it and an excitement to it that I don't think about the fact that this movie's two and a half hours. It's just that compelling the entire way through. When I saw this, it's like, how is this? Wow, I'm not sure how I'm going to feel about this. I ended up loving every minute of it.
Yeah, the 3 hours do sort of, I mean, it sort of, as I recall, it just sort of lose momentum back, but I, you know, entirely, because I know I'm one of various insufferable Twitter discourses is movies are too long. why is it the mini theory not a movie?
Yeah.
I care more about whether the movie earns its runtime.
Yeah.
Because I've seen movies that were I've seen movies that were 100 minutes felt longer than Copland.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I mean, definitely.
I mean, Killers of the Flower Moon was 200 minutes, and it felt shorter than movies that I've seen that were 90 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. You know, and no, absolutely.
So I don't have a problem with length. Just does the movie earn its runtime?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Roger Ebert really said best, like, no good movie is too long. No bad movie is too short. And I mean, that is the only important thing to really take into account when it comes to running time. It's not that, oh, it's like 3.5 hours. But how does it move? How does the story progress? How does it hold our interest while it progresses? And certainly, I mean, there are definitely moments where you can say, yeah, I mean, yeah, there are some things, especially, you know, especially when it comes to some of the middle passages that can get a bit bogged down. But at the same time, we're always interested because the characters are interesting. And I think this, you know, this is one of those movies where I was really struck by. One of the things I love about this film in particular that really resonated with me was the friendship that Candy has with the German soldier they end up having to duel with. And it's striking because of the fact that we see how that friendship progresses even as the world changes. And I think that is something that is that's something that really resonated with me in this, the idea that two people from very different walks, from two very different countries, two very different ways of looking at the world, they maintain this friendship throughout decades that is just absolutely just fascinating to watch. And even when Kurt's character gets in the middle of that, it doesn't impact their friendship. And I love that. I love it. It just deepens it to a certain extent. And seeing the way it plays out over the decades as this film progresses and as this story progresses is just one of the wonderful aspects of this film for me.
Yeah, definitely.
I am, you know, and the thing is, it's like this movie, this was the first one I watched for this this podcast, and I think the thing that struck me so much in this, and it's something that you do kind of probably because this was a little bit earlier than the other two movies we're going to discuss, there's an element to this movie that feels very theatrical. Like, it feels very much like it would be at home on the stage, but at the same time, it is very cinematic in the way that they shoot scenes, the way that they cut scenes together, the way that we get the use of music, the way we get use of color, the way we get used to artificiality. It's something that's very natural to this film in a way that really kind of disarmed me. And I think that's part of the reason why this was such a great one for me to start out with for this particular podcast, because it's like, okay, this is doing, and especially because of the fact that I think to a certain extent they do manage to get away from the theatrical trappings of early cinema in their later films. The fact that they make it work as well in this is really quite extraordinary.
Yeah, the translation to the stage thing is definitely interesting. I mean, at least I think it would benefit from the transition to the three-act structure that it probably comes with. Yeah.
Yeah. But at the same time, you also, the way that we get a whole lot of genres in this film, and I think that this is something you were pointing to earlier, where it's obviously a war film. There's also moments of physical comedy, especially in the hospital. There's genuine comedy that plays out when it comes to the duel, I think is very funny, where we first see Candy and Leo together. And then there's just this romantic yearning in Candy that is really, it's not just about his relationship to his country and his service to his country, it's also romantic relationships. But at the same time, we also kind of get there are also times where we do kind of feel like, I think he is somebody who is content to in the life that he's chosen.
I mean, definitely, yeah. Well, one could look at this Candy yearning for the love of his life as an absurdist demonstration of a familiar story about the one that got away.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. But yeah, this movie to me is just really, it was really just a wonderful, it was really just wonderful to take in for the first time, and I loved that it really gave me a sense of these filmmakers. I mean, even considering the films I'd seen of theirs earlier in life, this movie is so wildly different from them. You do get an impression of what they were like at the start, and I think that's always an interesting thing to see when it comes to filmmakers, and especially when you have these guys who are such absolute craftsmen who understand the importance of what the camera adds, what color adds, what different filmmaking techniques, what different editing techniques add to a film, and it's just absolutely beautiful.
Absolutely.
Did you have anything to add about Colonel Blimp before we continue?
If you have 3 hours, definitely check this. This is definitely a good use of your time.
Yes. And if you still have Max, I know it's available there. That's where I saw it, and I had an absolutely wonderful time watching this. We're going to go on to the next film, which was made by them in 1947. Also stars Deborah Carr in a very different role. And this is, it's funny because of the fact that I watched this again. This was the first one I had seen of their films, and it absolutely blew me away. I have to watch more of their work after this. It is 1947's Black Narcissus. And it is adapted from the novel by Rumor Godin. Is about sisters who basically are tasked with setting up a school and hospital in the Himalayas, and the psychological challenges they face in that process. You know, it's funny because of the fact that I don't know what exactly it was that made me choose this as the first Paul Pressburger that I watched, but it definitely made me feel like I made a good choice because of the fact that I think what this film does is that I think there are things about when it comes to faith. I think there are things about them when it comes to missionary work, when it comes to people who are kind of thrust into an extreme situation and they're struggling with figuring out how to navigate it. And I think that is such a, that, I mean, that's only part of what this film is about. 100 minutes, and there's so much in this movie that is just absolutely extraordinary.
Like, this movie was my own intro to the Archers.
Mm-hmm.
And also I love it so much that I always make it my mission to watch it on Easter or Christmas. Fairly outside the box, but
yes.
I don't like to always watch The Usual Suspects. Like, yes, I mean, while Colonel Blimp was like a war, was like a romantic comedy at war times, this is like a more like a more of a psychological horror film.
Yeah, but no, I definitely agree with you on the wildly different genres. I mean, you do have essentially a romantic comedy as well as a horror movie playing on Colonel Blimp. With Black Narcissus, it is very much a psychological horror film. It's almost, in a way, it's almost a training ground, I guess, for Powell for what he would do later in Peeping Tom. But I mean, it certainly doesn't go to that extreme when it comes to horror. But I think this is the type of movie. It's ultimately about survival, and certainly about it's. I think at its core it's about that, and I think one of the things that is really, I think one of the dynamics that is so interesting in this movie is the fact that Carr's character, Sister Clauda, is relatively young, and she's the one who's being put in charge of creating this school, creating this hospital, and basically leading these women, some of whom have many, many years on her, in telling, in creating this environment for them. And in a way, it's almost a challenge to her to, you know, it's almost like throwing her in on the deep end as in terms of her ability to lead. And I think that is one of the and then you see the ways that some of the sisters react to her, the way some of the sisters almost seem like they're challenging her. And it's I think it's such a fascinating use of dynamics, and the fact that the main character is as young as she is in this type of verse, in this type of role, I think is one of the most compelling parts of the film.
Yeah, I didn't think about that. I definitely didn't think about the youth factor.
I mean, I cannot say enough about Powell and Pressburger in their cinematography, in the way they use color in these movies. And I mean, obviously, it's a very generic thing to say based on like everything I had read about them before. But the fact is, it's just so remarkable. And I mean, we're not even at arguably the most remarkably visual film that they've gotten to yet. But I think this one, the way they use camera angles, the way they use shadow, the way they use light is really important to how this story unfolds, the way that we get sucked into the psychological reality of this story. It's just incredibly important to how this film plays out to us. And I think it's just absolutely breathtaking to see the ways in which these characters ultimately mean well and try to do their best, but this environment, this particular environment, almost gets the best of them in like every way.
Yes, especially Kathleen Byron as Sister Ruth.
Yes.
Yes. Oh my goodness. If I can't fall in love with a hot British guy, I would go on the brink of insanity like her. That's just me.
I mean, you know, I mean, well, like no, go ahead.
Even though there's no supernatural elements involved, she does play her like she's a woman possessed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even like the way, like we were talking about the use of shadow, like the glimpse of her like grinning at Sister Clauda, mm-hmm. with all the shadows covering her face, it's bone chilling.
Yeah, and the fact that just shows, and the fact that she chooses a red dress in order to when she decides she's going to leave the order, and I mean it's. All of it is done for deliberate impact. I mean, obviously that is an extreme way of looking at the challenges of celibacy, if you take on that responsibility. And But at the same time, it's you have this environment where you have these women in a culture that they do not necessarily understand, confronted with people who live their lives in a completely different way that they do. And they look at what they're trying to do as helping. And, you know, it's admirable that they're trying, but at the same time, you look at it in terms of the manner in which the ways in which some people of faith feel like helping means to get people in touch with what the missionaries believe, as opposed to helping people get in touch with what they believe. And I think that is one of the things that's always kind of interesting about how films approach missionaries. And I mean, not just this film. You think about Scorsese's Silence. You think about The End of the Sixth Happiness, with an amazing performance by Ingrid Bergman, and the ways in which people who are nominally basically asking people to believe what these outsiders believe, it's going to be a challenge. I mean, this is obviously an extreme manner, but at the same time, there are some people who are just not going to be up to the challenge of accepting that there are people in the way that they choose to live in their lives that is just not going to be conducive to their beliefs. And it's the ways in which Powell and Pressburger, I think, get to that is extreme, but it's also very compelling too, because of the fact that what we are seeing is women who probably are, and it's not just Sister Claudia, it's really all of these women are kind of thrown in on the deep end of how to deal with this type of life.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and we do see how even the missionaries themselves wonder if their way of life is the way to go.
Yeah.
Is the way to go.
Yeah.
They even Sister Ruth, like, in a very, even as she shows just how far off it makes her go, like, she is someone with a very, someone who doesn't want to, who wonders whether, I'm not quite sure how to say it.
Well, I mean, and she's somebody who, her feelings towards Mr. Dean are we can understand where she's coming from, and we can, you know, not necessarily in terms of why she feels that way towards that particular character, but why she's starting to feel that way when presented with, you know, it's like, it's one thing to say, oh yes, I'll, you know, abstain from all men, all lustful urges. It's another thing to actually put that in practice and to be challenged in that way.
Yeah, exactly.
It's going to be difficult. And I think, again, so much of this is about challenging Sister Claudia and the way that she leads these women. And, you know, sometimes you get the impression that she has a good idea of what to do. There are other times where it's just going to be overwhelming to her.
Yeah, and even somebody, if Sister Ruth, even one reason she become Sister Ruth becomes a foil to Sister Claudia is because Ruth is very open about her carnal wants and needs,
mm-hmm.
and feels like her line of work isn't right for her because she just happens to be sexually active, and she happens to be sexually active, and she notices that, and she's, but unlike Lotta, who's like, no, I'm as clean as a whistle. she's like, I'm as clean as a whistle now.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, Ruth can tell Claudia has feelings for her. She's just keeping them. She's just like suppressing them as hard as she can.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And, I think it's interesting that, you know, they have the Indian general who is they basically own the palace that the sisters are come into, and I think it's interesting the way that Claudia deals with him wanting to learn about what they're teaching. And, you know, he's an interesting character, I think, because of the fact that to a certain extent, I mean, he kind of feels like somebody who is very eager to learn about Christianity and to understand why these women believe the things that they believe. But at the same time, he's taking the wrong, somewhat of a wrong approach to it, even though I don't know that they're, if that makes any sense. He's got a very cavalier way of talking about their what they're preaching. And I will say, it's like Mr. Dean to a certain extent is right when he says later in the movie about Jesus being very casual, and it's like, yeah, I kind of understand that. I think that's a good way of looking at I think when we are confronted with some of the locals and the way that they approach what the sisters are talking about, I think that is some of the more interesting parts of the movie. And it just goes to show just how overwhelming this situation is going to be for these women.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it's not just the physical ice, not just the isolation and the temperature.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's truly difficult not to go back to the cinematography and the music. I love the music in this movie by Brian Easdale. I think he does a fantastic job getting to the psychological nature of this story. But, and then the cinematography by Jack Cardiff, which rightfully won an Oscar, is just absolutely breathtaking.
Yeah, you're definitely right about this. I mean, if only the drum beats alone.
Yeah.
Alone. Sort of get the adrenaline running. Like the scene towards the end where as Ruth is angrily repeating Claudia's name. Drum starts pounding, you're just like, oh. You're just like, oh shit. Stuff's about to hit the fan.
Yeah.
Stuff's about to hit the fan.
And it builds to a climax that is just absolutely jarring. I mean, it's one of the most famous images in the movie, but it doesn't make it any less shocking when you watch it, because of the fact that it's like you've seen somebody just go completely mad, and somebody with a sensible, who's trying to be sensible, you just can't reason with that. And the way that they are trying to deal with is just absolutely, it makes for a riveting third act of the film that I just really love.
Definitely. I mean, like the image of Sister Ruth stepping out of the shadows, it's like, yeah. Again, even though there's no supernatural elements and she's not a woman possessed, it's like with how she's pale as a, stepping out of the shadows, just pale as a ghost.
Yeah.
It just shows she's not only mentally gone, but even just how far gone she is from the sister we meet at the beginning of the film.
Yeah, exactly.
And also, quick foreshadowing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a bit of foreshadowing in that moment.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. This is just such a wonderful body of work here we're watching, and I just can't get enough of watching that movie. Watching it again this morning in preparation for this, I was struck all over again by what I loved about it in 2020, and I'm so glad that I ended up picking it up from Criterion shortly after watching it, just because of the fact that I knew I wanted to own it. Yeah. And absolutely,
it's in my collection as well.
It's such a fantastic film. Do you have anything more you'd like to say about before we continue?
Absolutely. This movie is just one of the most beautiful looking movies I have ever seen. If there was ever an opportunity to see a repertory screening, I would. You know, if there was like a repertory screening, and
yeah.
Like if I was in New York and saw there was a repertory screening, I would take the next train there.
Oh, absolutely.
It's just as effective at home, but I can only imagine just hearing those drum sounds on a on a big theater screen.
Yeah. Oh my god.
my world would probably alter.
Yeah, I do not doubt that. That would be an extraordinary experience seeing this on big screen. And I mean, you know, it's like the thing about it is, it's like the screen obviously is dramatically different now that we have CinemaScope, that we have TV framing, that we have, you know, we have flat, we have, you know, we have 1.85:1, we have 2.39:1. But the fact that all of these movies were shot in the box screening and just really, but you feel like they are all immersive in the way that they look and the way that they capture the type of tensions and the emotions that they're capturing is just absolutely amazing. And yeah, I can't imagine what that movie would be like, what Black Narcissus would be like on the big screen, but I'm kind of like you. I would love to find out, because of the fact that it's such a, it's a great experience at home, but I mean, no experience I think can compare with being on the big screen, and I can't imagine that being anything less than extraordinary on the big screen.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I would definitely say that about the third film that we're talking about, which was their next film, 1948's The Red Shoes. And
The Red Shoes.
It's funny because I tend to take notes when I'm working on prepping for a podcast. And I've got notes on all three of these movies, and so much of what I had to say about the red shoes is basically hyperbole. I usually don't do that, but there's something just absolutely unbelievable about this film. In the way that it looks, the way that it tells this story. And the thing that is so remarkable about this is that it's arguably the simplest story of the three from a narrative standpoint. It's basically,
yeah,
it's your typical, it's basically your typical, backstage rivalries of an overbearing theater director, a composer who's wanting to who's wanting to become a great composer, and an ingenue who wants to be a star. I mean, three very traditional archetypes for this type of story. And yet the way that this story unfolds, it feels very natural. It doesn't feel like we're watching the same type of story we've seen dozens upon dozens of times before. It has a lot of the same dynamics that we're used to. It has a lot of the second and third act complications that we're used to. It has so many of the mechanics of the plot that we're used to, but I can't look away. I'm just that enthralled by the performances and by the filmmaking, and it's just remarkable what Paul and Pressburger do in this film.
Absolutely. I mean, normally I don't like to immediately compare one older, I try not to compare films to another after I watch them, but after I saw The Red Shoes for the first time, I couldn't help but think of Black Swan.
Yeah, it definitely.
Another movie about ballet.
Yeah, that definitely it definitely came to mind while I was watching it too.
Except it's a bit like Black Swan, except from the theater director's point of view.
Yeah. And obviously it doesn't go into psychological horror either. I mean, the tensions in this movie feel very genuine, and they don't feel overblown in the same way that Black Swan does. But no, I completely saw that comparison like almost immediately when I was watching it. The way that Paul and Pressburger bring us into the worlds of these movies, I think is fantastic. And you have the opening stampede into the hall in this movie that really just gets you into the rush of adrenaline that this movie is ultimately going to give us when it comes to its story and the way the story unfolds. And I love, there are moments in this film that feel very natural. There are ideas in this movie that are very familiar to us. The idea of, what do we choose our creative ambitions over love? Do we choose our ambitions as you, our youthful ambitions greater than the professionalism of an old pro, and the tensions of those, and the way that the Red Shoes ballet is created, the way the ballets in general in this movie are created, it's just something we're watching we're watching something very intently in this film that is very mundane. If you've ever worked on preparing a performance, but at the same time, we're captivated by it because of the way that Powell and Pressburger stage this film, the way that they've chosen to tell this story. And it's just absolutely, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. And it's a remarkable film.
Yeah. Yeah. Keeping up with the theme of the archers and visuals, even like one key visual is key and striking visual is the titular shoes themselves.
Yes.
Which are so, in a film that has a very natural story, the bright looking shoes appear as if they're a magical object.
Yeah. Yeah.
The symbol for Norma Shearer's pursuit of fame, even if they may prove to be a cursed object for her.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And one of the things that's so impressive to me about this film, which, I mean, these are all basically equal films, but it feels like The Red Shoes is just a very tight notch above. But I mean, they're all excellent films. The way that they use cinematic technique when we are watching the production of The Red Shoes unfold, like, there are things that you could never really make happen in those days on the stage that are very cinematic techniques, but feel very natural when it comes to us watching the film in front of us. It feels like, well, yes, of course this is happening. And it's to your point of the red shoes of the title basically being magical objects in a very real way.
Yeah. Yeah, and it also plays into the technique of having supernatural weaving elements of fantasy, even if it's not a fantasy storyline.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, I mean, it's funny because of the fact that, I mean, I think to a certain extent that plays into something that's very Hollywood, right? The idea of creating art is something that is a very magical experience, or we imagine it to be a magical experience, even if it's not necessarily that. And I think, yeah, in a way, this film is closer to a Hollywood film than either of the other two films that we've talked about are.
Right. I guess makes sense as to why it's the only film by the Archers to be nominated for Best Picture.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, and it definitely, yeah, I mean, you can definitely see where Hollywood would have absolutely connected with this film entirely because of the fact that it's that type of movie that they would completely resonate with them.
Yeah, and as a movie, yeah, the fact that it's a stylized movie about show business.
Yeah.
And the pursuit of artistic perfection, I'm sure, is what resonated with them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I still haven't seen Hamlet, the movie that it lost to, but what a deserving winner it would have been.
It would have been a fantastic winner. Yeah, I mean, and look, I'm sure Hamlet's fine, but you know. Yeah. I would, like, right now, like, I mean, I adore the Treasure of the Sierra Madre, but it's like, I mean, you wouldn't get any argument from me if Red Shoes had won Best Picture. It's like, okay, I get it. It's that good. And it truly is. I think it's an absolute masterpiece. I think it's a delightful film. I mean, that is one of the things that I was so taken by with all three of these films that, I mean, they really, the stories they tell are very different. The subjects are very different. The way they approach the subjects are very different, but they all are entertaining in a lot of ways that we don't necessarily see coming right out of the gate. And I think you know, it's like Powell and Pressburger, I mean, they're famously two of the most beloved filmmakers from the era, certainly, and I think you can, and they definitely are filmmakers who had very distinctive ways of making their films, but the fact that they were able to go between genres that they did here, it almost puts them out of step with the quote-unquote great filmmakers of the era that I think we're kind of familiar with, right? Like Hitchcock,
yeah.
Capra, Billy Wilder. I mean, Wilder's another filmmaker who could go between genres effortlessly, but even Wilder to a certain extent. Yeah. So the fact that they were able to do that in a way that grounded the films emotionally, but also gave audiences a good time in watching them is really, it's really quite amazing to consider when we think about these two.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Well, is there anything else that you want to say about the Archers before we wrap up?
Well, if you want to, anyone who's an aspiring filmmaker, you should definitely, and want any a good influence, or looking for a good visual influence, you should, I'd say look no further than, I would say those who are among the top of the list of recommended filmmakers in that regard.
Yeah. And if you are not aware of this little piece of trivia, Michael Powell was married to Thelma Schoonmaker, Martin Scorsese's longtime editor, at the end of his life. So,
I did not know that. Or I think I knew, but I forgot.
Yeah, and Scorsese has listed Powell and Pressburger as a huge influence on him, and you can absolutely see that in the way he's told his own stories and the way he looks at editing, the way he and Thelma look at editing. It makes a lot of sense that these two are part of that DNA in terms of telling stories. And it was fantastic to finally watch these films. And Matt, it was great to talk to you once again.
Yeah, it was great to talk with you as well. Yeah, as always. It's always nice to talk with you, yeah.
Yeah. I'd like to thank Matthew for joining me on the podcast to discuss Powell and Pressburger. It was great to talk to him again, and I do hope to have him on again in the future. That's going to be it for this episode of the Sonic Cinema Podcast. We've got an interesting lineup coming up, and I hope you tune in for that. We've got some interesting discussions as well as some guests coming up, and I'm looking forward to that. I Once again, click subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also check us out at patreon.com/sonic cinema, as well as www.sonic-cinema.com. Thank you very much.